Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 6th of October. In just a moment, Dr. Stephen Vogt will be joining us, an astronomer and professor of astronomy and astrophysics at the University of California, Santa Cruz. He is part of a planet-hunting team that discovered an Earth-sized planet orbiting a nearby star in the habitable zone where water could exist. This is quite a finding. He said that a human colony could possibly exist there, and he believes that the planet does harbor life and that it may just be the first find of all kinds of planets like this that could have life. So this is going to be a wonderful hour as we talk with him about this amazing finding, which was 11 years in the making. We'll meet him in just one moment. This is the beginning of our pledge drive. As you probably know, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and joining me in our studios is Lisa Nalbandian, who's manager of our offices here in the Milwaukee area. This is, as you know, listener-supported Wisconsin Public Radio's fall membership drive, and listener donations are the foundation of our budget. It's why we're asking for you to give us a gift right now. Please give at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. Hello, Lisa.
Hello. Well, last hour we had a goal of 70 pledges, and this hour we have a goal of 50 pledges. These hourly goals are extremely important. They help us stay on track financially so we can keep the discussions going on Wisconsin Public Radio. Take a moment right now and give at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
As you know, we get a big kick out of, well, who wouldn't? Huge discoveries in space, and this is a very large one. In a moment, we'll be speaking with Dr. Stephen Vogt, who is an astronomer, about this exciting new astronomical find. And discussions like this on the Ideas Network are quite unique, and they are possible because of your financial support. Please give now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
This hour, you can get the Ideas Network anniversary mug for a pledge of $150. But remember, the important thing is to make a gift of any amount right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
It's pretty easy to give. All you have to do is this WPR.org or 888-202-2552. We'll just ask for your name, your contact information, the amount of your pledge, and how you would like to pay for it.
And use a credit card if you can. It saves both you and Wisconsin Public Radio time and the price of a stamp. Or better yet, sign up for automatic, sustaining donations from your bank account. And don't worry, we don't share your personal information with any other organizations. Give now, WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
As you know, on WPR, you hear substantial, very substantial topics. We don't patronize you by assuming that all you can handle is a headline. We know that you want a lot more than that. You're intelligent, sophisticated listeners, and we love that. Make your donation in support of these programs that are substantial, and they're with you every single day. WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Every dollar really does make a difference. And when you decide to pledge $120, that's $10 a month or more, you'll receive the WPR member card. The member card is a membership experience. Every time you get a 2-for-1 discount at a participating restaurant, B&B, golf course, or cultural attraction, you'll be reminded of how much you enjoy Wisconsin Public Radio. So pledge now, $120 or more, and receive the member card at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Our goal again is 50 callers this hour, and we have one. So we're on our way, Lisa. Give now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. With your pledge of $150, ask for the IdeasNet 20th anniversary mug, and you can couple that with you pledge during this hour when we are talking about this newly discovered planet. Pledge now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. 2552.
And consider becoming a sustaining member by making an automatically renewing monthly contribution from your bank account or credit card. The more sustainers we have, the more stable we are. And to thank you, we will plant a tree in Wisconsin on your behalf. Donate now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552, and thank you.
I like that, plant a tree. What does a Taurus say? Plant a tree, have a child,
right.
Write a book, and your life
right.
will be fulfilling.
So we can help you check at least one off that list.
All right. Thanks, Lisa. And talk about a guy who's got, probably had a very fulfilling life is our next guest, or our first guest today. Dr. Stephen Vogt is an astronomer and a professor of astronomy and astrophysics at the University of California, Santa Cruz. And he is a planet hunter. That's part of his job. They have made a remarkable discovery, this team that was headed by Dr. Vogt and also by people at the Carnegie Institution of Washington, discovered an Earth-sized planet orbiting a nearby star in the habitable zone where liquid water could exist. The findings are reported in a paper in the Astrophysical Journal. This is, he says, the first really solid discovery of a potentially habitable planet. The fact that we were able to detect this planet so quickly and so nearby tells us that planets like this must be really common. That is quite profound. We're going to be welcoming phone calls for him during the course of this hour. Our number for on-air participation is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and the email address is talk@WPR.org. Dr. Stephen Vogt, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Good morning.
Good morning. You must be a happy guy.
Yes, it's quite gratifying to have this result.
I would imagine it must be huge. Now, was it 11 years of looking and then you found something that you thought might be something and then the telescopes got better? Tell me about the process in discovering this.
Yeah, it's a gradual process. I mean, we've been doing planet hunting for the last 15 years, actually. This particular star has been on our target list of about 1,500 stars for the last 11 years, and we started off slowly because we don't have enough telescope time to hit all the 1,500 stars, so they have prioritization and cadence metrics that tell us when we can and should hit them. And we get about 15 shots at the telescope every year, about 15 nights a year, so that 15 nights has to cover all those stars. We started hitting this about 11 years ago, slowly. But then when a Geneva group found the first planet around this in 2005, we upped our priority and our cadence and began hitting it more frequently. And then two more planets were found in 2007, so we bumped it up even further in priority and started hitting it even more often. And then in 2009, another planet was found. So there were four around there found by 2009. At that point, we started to really hit it very intensely, not only to confirm the planets that the Swiss had found, but to see if there was anything else in the system. And finally, earlier this year, we began to see evidence of a fifth and a sixth planet, and one of these was in the habitable zone, and it's taken us the last 6 months to convince ourselves that it's real and that it was time to announce it to the public.
Mm. And what does it mean to be in the habitable zone?
That means that water could exist in liquid form on the surface of the planet, and that basically it's determined by the temperature range. It has to be between 0 and 100 degrees centigrade based on its distance from the star and how bright the star is and how hot the star is.
Mm-hmm. And there are some pictures of what this may look like where the sun is on the horizon. Half the planet is in darkness and half the planet is in light. Is that right?
Well, it depends on where you are on the planet. The planet is tidally locked to its star, like the moon is tidally locked to the Earth.
So
the moon keeps one face always towards the Earth.
Uh-huh.
This keeps one face always towards its star. So its rotation period is 37 days, but its orbital period is also 37 days. What that means is there's no day-night cycle on the planet. So if you're on the day side, it's always day, and the star never moves in the sky. And if you're on the dark side, it's always night. So the most pleasant place to be would be right on what's called the terminator, the line between light and dark. And from that vantage point, the star would always sit on the horizon. You'd have an eternal sunset, basically.
Hmm. And what would the temperature difference be between those two areas?
As near as we can tell, the temperature on the very hot side, pretty near where the sun would be directly overhead, would be about 160 degrees Fahrenheit. So it'd be a little bit toasty for human beings to live there. On the coldest side, it would be about minus 20 Fahrenheit. Not too bad, but you probably wouldn't want to live there. But then there'd be a continuous range in between. So around the Terminator, it would be a very pleasant, you know, probably 60, 70 degrees Fahrenheit.
Kind of perfect, huh? We're talking San Diego.
Yeah, right.
Huh. You talked about not getting enough telescope time. It seems to me as though there ought to be a telescope that's devoted entirely to this kind of planet hunting. Why do you only get 15 shots a year?
Well, we use the Keck telescopes in Hawaii, and those serve a fairly large community at the University of California and at Caltech. So there's, you know, over 100 astronomers that have to share that time. So every astronomer gets usually not more than about 2.5 days a semester. We get a bit more time than that, but you know, everybody has to do their own thing. So it's a shared facility, kind of like owning a condo, and that's all that's available, unfortunately. It would make a lot of sense to have a dedicated telescope that did this kind of work every single night of the year, and we are building such a thing. I'm just in the finishing stages of building a smaller robotic telescope, a 2.4-meter telescope at Lick Observatory, which is east San Jose in California,
mm-hmm.
And that will be able to do this kind of work every night of the year. It won't have quite the reach of the 10-meter Keck telescopes, but at least it'll be able to get pretty high cadence on a fair number of stars.
Is the problem money here, that the Keck is very expensive?
Yeah, each of the Keck's telescopes is $100 million. It's about $1 a second to observe with them, so it takes a fair amount of money. Ideally, what we would like to do, and we're hoping that the National Science Foundation or NASA will buy into this, there's a decadal report that came out from Astronomy and Astrophysics that set forth the path that we should take over the next 10 years. And one of its three goals was seeking nearby habitable planets. So this is, you know, one of its three main goals, and I think the best way to do that is to fund for about $50 million, a large robotic telescope, something like a 6 or an 8 meter telescope that's just dedicated to doing this work every night.
Mm-hmm. How far away is this planet?
This is a very nearby planet in astronomical standards. It's one of the nearest stars. It's 20 light years away, roughly.
And how did you know? We got this huge sky. How did you know where to look?
Well, it's fairly straightforward. Initially, when we did this searching, we didn't know how common planets were, and it was clear that you'd have to find a fair amount of stars to observe before you could find one. And there's something like, you know, 0.5% or 1% of stars were showing this. So you had to have hundreds of stars on your target list in order to have one or two of them show planets. As time went by and we got better at the techniques, we began to realize it was something like 10 to 12% of all stars show planets like Jupiter's or Saturn's or things. And then as time went even further by, people began to think it's probably more like 30%. So once the numbers got up that high, we realized that we didn't have to have a huge target list. And so we cut our target list down to the most important stars. And the most important stars are the ones that are the nearest stars and the ones that are the smallest, the M dwarfs. So we've really been focusing in the last 3 or 4 years on a few hundred very nearby M dwarfs, and this is one of those kinds of stars.
You said that given the relative ease of finding this planet, and you named it after your wife, didn't you?
Yeah.
That was nice. So what's the name of the planet?
It's called Zarmina's World.
Zarmina's World.
Zarmina, Z-A-R-M-I-N-A.
Nice. Based on finding this planet, that 10 to 20%, this is amazing, 10 to 20% of all stars may have potentially habitable planets.
Well, that's what the numbers work out to be. It's a fairly easy calculation to imagine. It's basically there are about 116 stars closer than this star. So if you consider a volume-limited sample, which is a sphere centered on us, on the sun, there's 116 stars in that sphere out to this star. Of those 116 stars, so far we've only looked at 9 of them with the kind of cadence and precision that you would need to see these sorts of things. And we've already found a habitable planet. So that tells you that there's basically in that sphere 2 habitable systems. There's us at the center, and there's this system, Gliese 581, Zarminus world. So that's 2 out of 116, or about 1.7%. Yet we've only looked at 9 out of those 116 planets, so there's another factor of 13 incompleteness. It gets you up to about 20%, and then there's another incompleteness factor that has to do with the fact that a certain fraction of the planets, of the systems, are highly tilted so that we're looking at them face on, and we couldn't see their planets using this technique. So quickly you're up to 10 or 20% just from the incompleteness factors.
What is your mind, and you have a mind unlike most of our minds, what does your mind do with that information?
Well, I find it to be quite staggering. And to me, the takeaway message is, wow, this one was found way too easily and way too nearby. What is that telling us? And to me, it says we're going to be finding a lot of these, and that Earth, habitable places, potentially habitable places like Earth, are probably not a freak. They're not rare. They're actually very common. When you take that number, 10 or 20%, multiply it by the 200 billion stars in our galaxy, you get staggering numbers like, 20 or 40 billion places that are potentially habitable out there.
So that means, of course, we all, at least I do, I've been waiting all my life to have us discover somebody or something living somewhere else, but the chances of there being not necessarily people, but something, do you have to go there with this information?
Well, it's really hard traveling even 20 light years, even to the nearest stars, like 20 light years. It's very hard, even with our best imagined technologies today, using what's called a nuclear pulse star drive, it would take about 200 years to reach this system. So that's a long time in human timescales, and it's not likely that we'd put humans on there because it would take multiple generations to make such a journey. But, within 200 years, you could imagine sending a robot there or a camera, the equivalent of a cell phone. You'd have to be a little patient. So I think what you quickly find is that creatures, let's put it this way, if there's more physics that we don't know yet, maybe it'll be possible. But given the laws of physics today, travel among stars is really tough and expensive.
Mm-hmm.
So most beings, I think, would choose to send information. And so you come back to this idea that SETI had come up with, a search for extraterrestrial intelligence, that the most efficient way to send information is probably on radio waves. So people would be communicating. They'd be phoning one another. They'd be tweeting one another. and there would be, the equivalent of a galactic internet out there. And people would be communicating on hubs of information, sending back and forth in packets of information at the speed of light. And so all we really need to do is figure out how to log on to the galactic internet, right? And do our Google searches on there.
Okay, let's do it. All right, we're going to welcome phone calls. Our guest is Dr. Stephen Vogt, an astronomer, professor of astronomy and astrophysics at the University of California, Santa Cruz. He is part of the planet-hunting team that discovered Zarminus world just recently, and this was the end of a process, well, the beginning of a process, because they are going to find many more planets like this, a process that took some 15 years. This is this Earth-sized planet orbiting a nearby star in the habitable zone where water could exist. Our phone number for you to ask questions about this remarkable discovery is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And our email, if you'd like to send one of those, can we do that? Yes. Thank you, Chrissy. That is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Let's go to your phone calls in a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this time period, Kurt Vonnegut's son will be with us. He has been struggling with mental health issues for a number of years. He is a pediatrician and, of course, grew up with Kurt Vonnegut. That must have been, we'll have to ask about that, as well as talking about the problems that he has been having treating young people for mental illness. There's a great disparity in the mental health system between mental health and physical health, although those are combined, certainly. But he will be with us the first hour of tomorrow's show. Nancy Pearl joins us the second hour. All right, let's go to phone calls. I know we're going to have some wonderful calls, and let's start with Paul from Duluth, Minnesota. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Kathleen. I knew you would pick this topic up. Astronomer, I have a pretty clear understanding about how you go about detecting these planets, but I'm puzzled how you were able to determine that it's tidally locked. And just as a corollary, what must the weather be like in that temperate zone? And I'll listen off the air if I could.
Okay, sure. Thanks for the call, Paul.
Yeah, the issue of tidal locking is a fairly straightforward calculation to make theoretically. We know the strength of gravity just from the distance from the star, and we know the gradient of gravity across the planet. At that point, you have to invoke a thing called a tidal quality factor, Q, which is part of the calculations, and we have a fairly good understanding of what tidal quality factors are depending on the composition and the density of material, and assuming this is not made out of marshmallow cream, but it's made out of the sort of things that planets are made out of, we can work that out. And you end up having a time scale for tidal locking that you compute, and the time scale turns out to be a fair bit less than a billion years. And we know this system's about 4 billion years old, so we know it would have tidally locked fairly quickly in the formation process just from those calculations alone.
4 billion years old?
Yeah, 4 billion years old. So it had plenty of time to tidally lock. It would have tidally locked pretty quickly.
And how old are we?
Well, we're about 5 billion years old right now. The Earth is probably four, something like that, four point something.
Uh-huh.
So a similar age. The issue about the weather, that's actually been worked out in a fair detail. A gentleman a number of years ago took the three-dimensional global circulation model that's used for modeling the Earth's weather patterns, and applied it to this kind of situation of an Earth-like planet tidally locked around an M-star. And he worked out the wind velocities and temperatures and such, and it turned out that it actually is not too bad. You have high-altitude winds similar to the jet streams on the Earth that circulate heat from the hot side to the cold side, and some of that is returned, much of it back over the poles in terms of low-altitude winds, so the poles are fairly cold. But the winds down near the surface are actually quite benign. Maximum winds get up to 20 or 30, 40 miles an hour, so those would be sort of like mild gale. And over much of the planet, the winds would only be basically less than 10 miles an hour. They'd be breezes down near the surface. So there wouldn't be hellacious winds blowing everywhere down near the surface, and it would be quite pleasant, actually, around much of the planet.
So do you go there in your dreams at night?
No, not yet.
I bet you will. You just described it well enough for it to enter our dreams tonight, that's for sure. Our guest this hour is Dr. Stephen Vogt. He is one of the heads of the planet hunting team at the University of California, Santa Cruz, that made this remarkable announcement last week, the first really solid discovery of a potentially habitable planet. It is 20 light years away, and he had named it after his wife, which I think is wonderful, Zarmina World. We're welcoming phone calls for him about this discovery, and even more remarkable is that this is just the tip of the planets, that there are probably many, many, many more, which is pretty astounding. Our phone number for you to be on air is 800-486-8655, and we have one line open for you. This is, of course, our Wisconsin Public Radio Fall Membership Drive. I'm Kathleen Dunn, and Lisa Nalbandian is joining me in our Milwaukee studios. I love the fact that Paul called and said, I knew you'd pick up on this topic, and that's right. People know that we'll pick up on certain kinds of topics, and this is just an extraordinary show, I think. As a regular listener to this program, you know that you will always hear something worthwhile. We pick up news, and Rhonda and Chrissy are terrific at getting guests who have done this groundbreaking research and made phenomenal discoveries. We're asking you to put a value on this program during this pledge drive. As you know, your contribution is quite vital to WPR. It's a big part of what keeps us going. Support this program, these kinds of interviews, and everything else you hear on Wisconsin Public Radio by making a gift in any amount at WPR.org, WPR.org, or 888-202-2552.
We're looking for 50 pledges in about the next 30 minutes. Thanks if you've already given. If not, help us stay on track by making your contribution right now. WPR.org or 888-202-2552. You decide the amount of your pledge. And ask for the Ideas Network Anniversary Mug as your thank you gift when you give $150 or more at WPR.org. Or 888-202-2552.
How many times have you been listening to the Ideas Network and you heard something that stopped you in your tracks? Something that was really interesting. It happens to me almost every day that we hear things. And this show is really a case in point. You can take this program and speak with your children and your friends about this remarkable discovery. You go to the internet, you look at what this planet may look like, you think about the implications. I mean, it just doesn't get any better than this. I'm not kidding you. We strive every day for programs that really open your eyes and engage your brain, programs that affect your life and may affect many generations to come. This kind of radio happens only with your financial support at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
After paying your bills, it might not be easy to find anything extra. That's why it's up to you to decide how much to give. Any donation makes you a member of WPR when you pledge at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. How much you give is not as important as the fact that you do give.
Giving to WPR a choice because it's something you value, you'll probably find that choosing to donate is enjoyable. Find out now by going to WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
You can listen to WPR every day for years and you'll never get a bill. We don't count how many minutes you listen. We don't put a meter on your radio. Instead, we use the honor system. We count on you to voluntarily make a pledge to pay for the listening you do. And remember, you decide how much WPR is worth to you. A dollar a week? Two? A dollar a day? You decide. Then go to WPR.org or call 888-202-2552.
Thanks very much, Lisa. Please pledge during this hour because we're taking you to other worlds. We do that all the time. We take you to other worlds. Our guest this hour, in case you're just tuning in, is Dr. Stephen Vogt. He has made a remarkable discovery. He's the head of this planet-hunting team from the University of California, Santa Cruz, that made this, announced this discovery. It's been many years in the looking of an Earth-sized planet orbiting a nearby star in the habitable zone where water could exist. We're welcoming phone calls for him, and let's go next to Scott from La Crosse. Hi, Scott.
Kathleen.
Hi, Scott.
Hey, just wanted to tell you, I'd probably be a member anyway, but boy, programs like this sure don't hurt.
Don't you love them? I love them too.
Yeah, you know, this whole idea, it just gives me chills.
I know.
My question for you, sir, is the following. First of all, hi, you banana slugs. I love that you named your football team your sports those slugs. But what I'd like to ask about is, and I apologize, as Kathleen knows, I'm old and kind of forgetful. But I read a book recently by a guy who's actually on the SETI welcoming committee, And he had a criticism that said that SETI, this is about the galactic internet, he said that what really SETI is out there looking for in the terms of the band, the radio bands that they're actually monitoring, is actually pretty limited, and that really they're, you know, that people could be using a whole different means of communication, and they said he would not catch it. And I'd like to ask your comment about that. This guy, I forget his name, unfortunately, but I think he's at the University of Arizona, and he's Australian originally, and I know he's written a lot of books. But at any rate, he was speaking about that in this book, addressing that issue. And then I'd like to ask you whether this neighborhood is one that SETI, in fact, has been monitoring for that elusive contact.
Okay, well, yeah, certainly we have to imagine the possibility that there's physics or there's techniques that maybe we can't even imagine today that, you know, thousands of years from now we'll look back and say, boy, were we stupid, why didn't we think about that? Right now, all we can do, and all SETI has been able to do, is to work with the known laws of physics to try to find the most intelligent way to look for things, and that seems to be radio waves. They could also communicate using laser pulses, high-energy optical laser pulses, and SETI has in recent years been looking for that as well. You can actually outshine your star with a directed laser for short bursts of time. So we've also been doing what's called optical SETI. Of course, they may also be communicating using dream waves, and you know, we don't know how to detect dream waves yet. But they could be, and they could have been doing it for a long time. One of the things that one has to think about, though, is that it would be pretty hard to detect us and our TV and our radio broadcasts from even 20 light years away. So if the beings on that planet, on the one we just detected, were actually listening to the Earth, they would need really, really large radio telescopes to do that. So it's not likely that we would just happen to sort of pick up the leakage from the TV or radio broadcast of another planet. They'd have to be sending us a beacon, and we could easily detect a beacon if they really wanted to let us know that they were there and send out a really good strong radio signal that we could see, and that is what SETI is hoping to pick up. So that's kind of the way the search would go forward. I don't have a lot of contact with SETI. I would imagine that they would be looking very strongly at this system now. There is one interesting possibility that I haven't really elaborated yet, but I've been thinking about, and that is that since this planet is tidally locked, we know its rotation phase all the time. So we know exactly every 37 days it comes right within our field of view. Whatever beings are on, say, the terminator of the planet, every 36 point, whatever the number is, 6.78 days, it's right in our field of view. So if they're sending out a beacon, we know the periodicity now, and that gives us a very sensitive way of looking for a beacon. We'll have a strict periodicity of 37 days, and we'll know its phase as well. We'll also know its radial velocity because it's attached to the planet. So this is these are some additional, basically, keys that we could use to search for a potential beacon from a place like this. And every time you find a potentially inhabitable world that is tidally locked to its star, you have that key that you can use.
And can you describe this beacon to me a little more fully?
Well, if we were to make a beacon on this planet, what we would do is we would take the Arecibo radio dish down in Puerto Rico, and we would pump power in it and send radio waves out into space, directly straight out overhead from the dish, and just beaming straight out into the heavens. And that beacon would sweep around as the Earth moved, as the Earth rotated. It would just sweep that beacon around like a searchlight at a shopping mall, you know, opening up a new store or something.
Let's go next to, thanks, Scott, as always, for your call. You need to come and meet us sometime. We love your calls. Gary from Boscobel, hi.
Thank you, Kathleen. I wanted to ask your professor a hypothetical question. Stephen Hawking says that if there was extraterrestrial life traveling through the universe, that it would need to consume resources from various planets as it moves through the universe. And he suggests that maybe it would be a good idea for humans to keep a low profile just in case any travelers would be looking for resources to continue their travelers. And on the other side of the coin, if we were traveling to other habitable planets, human beings, it seems, would be put in the same position where we would be looking at other planets to extract resources for our survival also. And those resources would, I'm sure, include food, which may be the inhabitants of other planets. I was wondering if I could comment on that.
Well, yeah, I think that, of course, if you look at how our species, the human species, has treated all the other species that it has met on this planet, we tend to basically dominate and eat most of other species. So there's no reason to believe anything else from a superior species out there in space. If it was superior to us, it would probably treat us like cows or something like that.
That's
possible. So, yeah, it would probably try to harvest, food, energy, or whatever from us, or labor, or whatever. So maybe it would be a good idea to keep a low profile until we were sure that they meant us no harm. Now, it's also possible that they have ascended to some different level of ethical perfection, and that they're beyond that. They don't need to use lower species for their resources. You know, if you have the ability to travel among the stars, you're probably not resource limited. You probably figured out how to manipulate atoms to make your food on the spot, because you'll be going a long time between filling stations, so to speak, and I doubt that the resource problem will be one that is really urgent. You'll probably have figured that out already.
Oh, but if they hadn't, when you say that they may treat us like cows, you mean they may eat us?
Sure.
They may eat us. I never thought of that.
Well, I mean, they'll be awful hungry if they've taken 200 years, you know, at a fraction of the speed of light to reach us.
I understand.
So, yeah, they'll want to eat something, whether they eat, you know, organic stuff like us or dirt or water or whatever, who knows. My sense is that if they can travel 200 years across the gulf of even 20 light years of space, they will have brought enough food where they won't be all that hungry when they get to the other end.
Yeah. More phone calls in a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Last week, a team of planet hunters led by astronomers at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and the Carnegie Institution of Washington announced the discovery of an Earth-sized planet three times the size, the mass of Earth, orbiting in a nearby star at a distance that places it squarely in the middle of the star's habitable zone. This is a remarkable discovery, and we're speaking with one of the lead astronomers this hour of our program. We do want to remind you that we're in a pledge drive, and we're a little bit off from the number of calls we need to have to stay on topic. So, I mean, this is a big guest. It's a big show. And if you love this kind of information and a chance to speak with somebody who has made this discovery, please call with your pledge. It's 888-202-2552, or you can go to WPR.org. And we thank you very much. Jeff from Milwaukee is our next caller. Hello, Jeff.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm calling regarding, what would the oxygen content be, you think, on the planet, and how would you generate an oxygen content through forestation and vegetation? I mean, that would be kind of critical, wouldn't it?
So the question is, what is the oxygen content in the atmosphere?
Right, or how would you create it?
Yeah, we don't have any detailed knowledge of what the gas constituents of the atmosphere are. On Earth, of course, oxygen was created by ancient bacteria that ingested CO2 and created oxygen and plant life, that sort of thing. So life itself created the oxygen biosphere in our own atmosphere, and that's how that would be done, through forestation and oxygen-producing cyanobacteria and such. But we don't have any direct evidence of what's going on in the atmosphere at all with this thing. We do know that it has a mass that's a bit more than the Earth, and so it has a gravity that's actually about maybe 1 to 1.5 times that of the Earth. So we know it has a much better chance of holding on to its atmosphere, whatever it outgassed, than the Earth did, or certainly than Mars did. Mars lost its atmosphere because it didn't have enough mass. So the chances of it holding on to any atmosphere are good.
Thanks for the call. Fred in Watersmead, Michigan. Hi, Fred.
Hi, Kathleen. Wow. All in the same week, this topic and my favorite, Donna Brazil. I'm just...
You're having a good time.
Yeah, I'm just wow. You know?
Good.
Couple questions. I think I read where the temperature on the dark side gets to minus 160. I think you said at the beginning of the show in the twilight zone it might be 63 degrees. I was wondering how wide is that twilight zone where they think life, you know, would exist? And then last is just a comment. I never thought of the Earth being considered a fast food stop or a drive-in, you know, for extraterrestrials. But I'll hang up and take your comments.
Thank you, Fred.
Yeah, actually, the hottest part of the planet would be something like 160 Fahrenheit. The coldest part would be something like minus 20 or minus 30 Fahrenheit. The comfortable place for humans would be the Terminator. And there would be a continuum of temperatures from the hottest part to the coldest part. You'd get every temperature in between. It would just be a question of longitude. As you moved in longitude around the equator, you'd go from the maximum hot temperature to the maximum cold temperature and everything in between. So I'm just guessing off the top of my head that there'd be a region that was probably 20 or 30 degrees wide in longitude around the equator, where temperatures would be quite pleasant for us. You could certainly live at the coldest temperatures. It would be like, you know, living up in the Arctic region, so you'd be an Eskimo, you know, and you'd have igloos or whatever. But most people would choose to live in that mild region around the Terminator, in the same way that most people on the Earth choose to live within 20 or 30 degrees of the equator of the Earth.
Dr. Vo, we had an email from Justin in La Crosse who wanted to know if you have a website, because we don't want to leave this conversation here. It's one of those that you've got to go find more information. Do you have more information on your research?
Sure. Well, you know, I don't put a lot of energy into my website. We threw a few things on there so that people could download some information about this discovery, but I don't really maintain my website that much. But they can find the website. It's at www.ucolick.org. That stands for University of California Lick Observatories, James Lick Observatory.
Okay.
And then it's /tilde VOGT, and that'll get them to my humble website.
Okay. And how does your wife feel about your making her immortal?
Oh, she gets kind of a kick out of it. The name, it's actually Zarmina's World.
Zarmina's World.
Zarmina's World. Yeah, it's kind of cute. We have a little fun with it.
I'm sure you do. Thank you ever so much for being with us. It was a fascinating hour, and congratulations on your truly remarkable discovery.
Well, thank you, Kathleen. Nice to be with you.
Yeah, very nice to have you here. Our guest this part of the show, Dr. Stephen Vogt, and this is a huge discovery, this Earth-sized planet orbiting a nearby star in the habitable zone where water could exist. Zardina's World is the name of the planet, so named by the lead planet hunter, Dr. Stephen Vogt. We thank him so much for being with us, and thanks to Rhonda Fanning for getting us this guest. As you know, we love these huge scientific discoveries, and we always talk about them, and we get the people who have done the huge scientific discoveries, which you won't hear conversations like this anywhere else. I just love this stuff. We're going to put the information on Facebook, too, on the Kathleen Dunn Show, in case you missed all of that because you were listening so intently. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Lisa Nabendian is joining me in our studios in Milwaukee. This is our Wisconsin Public Radio Fall Membership Drive, and I know that you count on WPR. I love that comment. I knew you'd pick up on this as a show, somebody said earlier, and I'll bet you say that a lot. We count on you to keep these discussions on the air. And we ask you, please, to make a gift of any amount right now and help us pay for the programs that you depend on. Please give now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. Hi, Lisa.
Hello. Well, this hour, we need about 40 more pledges in the next 10 minutes. Pledges like yours keep us on track to support the programs you count on. Thank you so much if you've already given. If not, give now, WPR.org or 888-202-2552. You decide the amount of your pledge. And remember to ask for the Ideas Network 20th anniversary mug when you give $150 or more. Pledge now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
I know you've been enjoying the conversation, how could you not, with Steve Vogt. It was pretty riveting about a new planet discovered 20 light years away. And there may be many other planets like this. And we started talking about possible life living there and actually beings living there who we hope don't treat us like cows if they come and see us. We ask you to take a few minutes to make this hour and many more hours possible. I just love doing radio like this, and we ask that you put a value on the programs that you enjoy every day, programs like this. We're a little stalled. We need to get 50 pledges, and we're at 7 right now. So I know there are more than 7 of you listening who love this kind of radio. If you do, please make your pledge at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Giving at WPR.org or 888-202-2552 is easy. All it takes is a gift of a dollar or two a week and a few minutes of your time. If you're wondering which payment method is the most convenient, give EFT a try. It's ongoing monthly transfers from your bank account. A dollar or two a week adds up to about $50 to $100 for the year. And all year long, you'll benefit from this program and all of WPR programs that you love. Make your contribution at WPR.org or 888-202-2552 and give as generously as you can.
You've got something dynamite. I mean, I just want to give the biggest, most sincere thanks to the people that that had this as their brainchild and that worked to see it to its fruition. It's just, you know, it's one of the tools of democracy that we have. We don't have town hall meetings anymore, but we do have an electronic town hall meeting on the Ideas Network.
Please call with your pledge to the Ideas Network. The number is 888-202-2552, or you can go to WPR.org. Maybe your gift is $50 or $100 or $500. Whatever amount you choose is the right amount. WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
We're looking for 40 more pledges in the next 8 minutes. So make yours right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And you can decide the amount of your pledge. Ask if you'd like for the Ideas Network mug so you can have your coffee or tea or water as you're listening to the show. And you'll get that if you give $150 or more. WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Maybe you found yourself thinking about something in a new way after you've heard one of our shows. Maybe you're thinking about that brand new planet after today's show.
Right.
And that's the beauty of the Ideas Network. You hear multiple points of view. You value what you hear on the Ideas Network. Now pledge your support at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
You know, Lisa, I have an entirely new thought. I'm thinking of myself as a cow after listening to the last hour. I've never thought of that before. Please, I don't want to be a cow. I mean, I like cows, but if you have the capacity right now, share your passion for WPR with others by making a pledge of $1,000. And some of you, I know, love us so much, and you're financially able to do that. Radio is accessible to everyone, but particularly during these tough times, not everyone has the means to support it. So your gift of $1,000 will support your listening, and it makes WPR available in your community. Every pledge, no matter the amount, is appreciated. WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Maybe you've only discovered Wisconsin Public Radio recently. or maybe you've been listening to WPR for years. We want you to know that Wisconsin Public Radio is listener-driven, not profit-driven.
WPR is your station. Pledge now, support now, WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
The best way to support this intelligent source of news and information is by donating at WPR.org. Put your contribution to work right away by making your pledge with your credit card.
And it takes really just a moment of your time. It's a very simple process. You'll be talking to nice people if you call, and you'll be investing in a station that keeps you informed every single day. This really is a treasure, and I know many of you know that, but think about all you learn. It's just incredible. Your contribution of any amount is really loved. WPR.org, 888-202-2552. Thanks, Lisa, so much. Lisa Nalbandian. We have news coming up in a moment. We want to thank Rhonda Fanning for the terrific production job and getting Dr. Stephen Vogt. Pledge for our producers, too. We have top-notch guests on this show. I mean, I'm proud of what we do. Thanks to Chrissy Pease, also producing this program. And please call with your pledges. We need to get to 50, and we're a ways away. So give us a call. Thanks.